I travel, fishing and hunting. There was plenty for all. We had a good living from the land. Alaska is my home, my land. This is where I was born. This is where my people before me lived and their folks before them. They lived here, survived, and were happy. There is no room any longer. We can no longer trap for furs. We can no longer fish or hunt for a living. Now there is no land we can call our own. There are no jobs for us. My people are unhappy. We could read many statements that reflect this point of view. The right to, the desire to maintain use and occupancy of the land. I find this particularly important because of the terms in which the testimony was given. In the testimony, Native Alaskans continually spoke to their kinship with the land and their desire to preserve their relationship to the land. In so doing, they reflected a relational concept of ownership that's very different from the possessive concept of ownership typical of Western society. By a relational concept of ownership, what I mean by that is that instead of saying, for instance, that an individual had a right to use a particular place because he owned that particular site, in the testimony, Native leaders said that they had a right to use land because their grandparents had used the land before them. For the Yupik Eskimo I know, a person is often, or a young man, may be named for his grandfather. And in being named for his grandfather, he is basically, his grandfather is born again in him. His rights to use a particular site are partly in the fact that he is his grandfather. His grandfather hunted species at that particular site, harvested fish and game. Because he took proper care of those species that he harvested, those species will come back to his grandson, who is him born again. So again, you don't use a site because you own that particular piece of property, but because of the relationship you hold to your ancestors and to your descendants that will come after you. Thus, I think the testimony basically tried to translate this basic cultural tenet. The point was not, and this was a comment that was made during the overview hearings that were held in January when we were first discussing these papers. The point was not that the land belonged to the natives, but that the natives belonged to the land. And for both elders and young leaders testifying, this was the primary, I think, yet often unstated issue of the Claims Act, that Claims Act was asked to resolve. And this is still an issue today. Let me read on page 10 of the paper. Fred Paul testified, "A native culture demands that he teach his children that which his forefathers taught him, to preserve the gifts of nature for his children and grandchildren, and that selling his birthright is utterly abhorrent. Selling or releasing is a thought which is not within the understanding or comprehension of the native. It is anathema." In a stateside lawsuit, an Indian chief was asked if he had authorized anyone to sell his fishing rights. His majestic reply expresses the present thought. "No, my fishing rights are like my body. I cannot sell them." I cannot overemphasize the emotional attachment that their respective Indian families and leaders feel for their home country. Perhaps another way of putting it is, if one sells his family's inheritance, he will surely go to the native's hell. He will be accursed throughout his lifetime and in the life there hereafter. Al Ketzler, going on page 11, testified, "We never have and cannot yet think of ourselves as a people being separate from the land itself. Our identity is based on the land we come from, the place where our ancestors have always lived before us. The families have their own fishing sites established by tradition, handed down from generation to generation. But what is probably one of the most important things to us is that we have a deep instinctive feeling of helplessness as a people. As long as we are cut off from the land, we are essentially a people to whom a land comes first. We are its children. We have emotional ties to it that we can never forget, even down into generations that no longer live in the old way. It is a basic part of our identity. It makes us feel who we are, and without it, we have been cut off. We have been cut off and bewildered." Again, there is a multitude of testimony that makes these same points again and again. So again, I state that this concern with continuity in the relationship with the land was a primary, again, but often unstated issue that the Claims Act was asked to resolve. Now, under the issue of use and occupancy, there are several other identifiable concerns, and I'll go through these briefly here. The first would be testimony to the effect of the present and past frustration of land rights. And I think one of the most moving examples, and I'll only read briefly from it, would be that of Lucy Avacana from Beachy Point. On page 12 of the paper, I have a home in Beachy Point, and it still stands. My parents, a brother, and my first husband are buried there. My children were born there. It was our home for many years. On my last visit 2 years ago, I found I no longer could call it my home because the white man had trespassed and taken over my land and home. The land around my home was torn. Also, the graves of my loved ones were trampled with machinery. I did not like what I saw, and I went to see a lawyer in Anchorage. She concludes at the end that the land where the Eskimos and Indians lived on should not be molested. This promise has already been broken many times already. I told the lawyer I was an Eskimo, but I fully respect the white man's law and that I have learned what is right and what is wrong because it is the teaching of our ancestors. Another primary concern was the fear in the decline of the resource base. I think Peter John of Minto gave, yeah.
Mr. Paul Tiolana has arrived. Thank you, sir, for coming. And I apologize that we started without you, but we're glad you're here. And I hope you have a copy of the Ann Reardon's paper. Rosita can give you a copy if necessary. And I understand that Mr. Roy Ewan is here. And sir, we're glad you came. And through some mix-up, we don't have a place card for you, but please come and join the round table and take one of these seats over here by John Borbridge, if you wish, or next to Fred Paul. And if Charlie Edwardson or Frank Peterson, whose seats I've invited you to take, object, we'll all deal with them when they... Let me turn up.
Shall I forge ahead here? Wait for it. Okie dokie. No problem, no, that's great. Okie dokie. Okay.
By the way, I think if you want a coffee, just go and get one, and I think it's better that we just carry on without a coffee break, because sometimes when we break for coffee, it's hard to get everybody back together again. We'll just see how it goes.
Okay, I have given then Lucy Avacana's testimony to the frustration of use of land, of traditional use and occupancy of the land. Then a second concern expressed in the testimony was the fear in the decline of the resource base. Peter John of Minto gives one, I'll quote his testimony to give one example of that. Peter John testified, "All these lakes that were good for hunting and trapping have been filled up with sand, so that's the reason why there is no fur now in the Minto Flat area. There is hardly any fur to make a living on. That's the reason why we want this land so badly, because if we haven't got this land, we won't have anything to depend on." I'll be running through these quickly now. That's not to not give them weight. These were major concerns, and for each of these concerns, innumerable quotes could be given to make these points. These mentioned came up again and again and again. Next, we had the need to hunt and fish over extended areas. That was talked about a lot. And an example of that would be Ernest Kichnick, who testified, The fact that he is now in his later years, getting kind of old to be hunting like he used to, but he does have grandchildren in it and children, and he feels that if the land is given to the Eskimos in a small package, you might say, he can see the problem of not being able to go out further to follow the migration of animals up there that is available for hunting. And he has this feeling of not having enough land for his children and grandchildren to hunt in. I'll go on. Well, Willie Hensley also testified, we feel that continued use and occupancy of large areas of land is necessary. Indeed, there are many groups throughout the state who would rather be assured of continued use and occupancy of their traditional lands rather than accept a penny from the federal government. Interestingly enough, also, the fear of losing these use of extended areas of land was also said to have kept people from testifying. Peter John testified again, a lot of my people are really worried about land claims. They are confused and don't understand. Many of them think that they will make the government mad by claiming the land. They think that if they lose, they would also lose a lot of their freedom to hunt, fish, and trap on their land now. That is why it is hard for me to get anybody to go with me to these land claims meetings. Okie dokie. Another concern, again, would be that broad tracts would be maintained for economic development and financial security, as well as for use and occupancy in the traditional manner. This view was expressed especially by prominent Native leaders. In other words, that timber to be developed on the land by Native groups, that the oil, if it be developed, were to be developed, some of the benefit of that that would come back to Native groups. I'll give an example there of Don Wright on page 15 of the paper. Don Wright testified, it seems like the least that could be done is give them part of that land so that they can join the boom in the Kenai area. And the same thing is true of Southeastern. I think those villages are entitled to some of that prime forest land. When these sawmills and these industrialists move in from Japan, there is no reason that the natives can't do this, his own logging and sell his own timber. I think they should be given an opportunity to get into some of the economically valuable land right away. I mean, not after it's all done. Thus you see that land is given, it's talked about in the testimony, was here seen as the key to a brighter economic future. It was necessary in order to enable the natives to make a transition, according to Emil Noti, to make the transition from subsistence economy to a wage economy, to make possible active participation in development. Finally, there was the issue of encroachment that comes up in discussions of the land, of use and occupancy of the land, and there's an ambiguity or a tension here between the desire on the part of the Native community to fully participate in the wider society and to maintain self-sufficiency in issues of economic development as well as in issues of land use. This desire for exclusive use and occupancy of the land is a special case of broader issues of independence and control that we'll be talking about as we get going here. The second major concern that I identified in the testimony is the importance of cash compensation in order to facilitate economic development. So here we see the aspirations as having a twofold objective. First, land title was necessary to maintain subsistence land use patterns and the cultural values that they supported. And second, land and cash were necessary so that the natives could move into the contemporary mainstream. Cash compensation was important for resource development. A combination of land and revenue was seen to be critical, a combination of the two. Yet in this, cash is seen as a means to economic development, not as an end in itself. Land is always primary and compensation secondary, as stated in the testimony, or as given in the testimony. The third concern expressed in the testimony was that the resolution of the Natives express the desire for the resolution of social, past social ills, and full participation in the future. The land claim settlement must provide, or was asked to provide, a vehicle for participation by the natives in the life of society as a whole. The land claim settlement wasn't going to be a cash out, but a means of transition out of past poverty, ill health, unemployment, and lack of education. And I'm going to quote here John Sackett from Hooslea, who stated, "Let me stress further that the bill before you is not just a question of land, it is a grasp, a handlehold for the development of our future." The goal then, land claims, was seen as the key to full participation in the future. The natives wanted to be part of progress. Here I quote Ruby Tansey, who testified, "The future of Cantwell and other native villages is very dim. Cantwell is already almost absorbed in the white world. The people do not want to stop progress, but want to be part of progress and benefit from it, because we can't benefit from it if we don't have title to our land." The means then to accomplishing this full participation in society as a whole was seen as the destruction to be the means of doing that was through the destruction of health and educational barriers. The natives viewed themselves as, and they were viewed by non-natives as well, as being locked in an invisible reservation. They were second-class citizens, and they wanted out of that particular situation. Frank Degnan testified, "The next point I attempted to make was that there were certain health and welfare needs in which title to Alaskan lands may make possible future development on the part of Native communities. I also pointed out that in my village and in others, better and more healthful water systems are needed. Along with this is a terrible need for more adequate housing for my people. Our housing can only be described as primitive by modern American standards. Reliance upon BIA to achieve something better in the housing field has thus far proved futile. We desperately need an adequate housing program for the villages. The next point I wish to make was the need for hospitals and better transportation to and from my village. At the present time, the nearest hospital is in Nome, which is approximately 300 miles away." So transportation, housing, healthcare, education, all of these needs were expressed, and the desire that these needs be addressed, that the land claim settlement address these needs. Education was another major concern. And here it's interesting, I'll read some examples of the discussion of education and the desire for increased educational opportunity. The issue in education was equal access to the educational system, not assimilation. And the dangers of integration were, if perceived, not articulated in the testimony. Again, the question was equal access. They wanted to be allowed to have education in non-segregated schools as opposed to the segregated BIA system. Quoting Charlie Franz on page 20. Actually, let's start quoting Lucy Brenwick, testified from Copper Center. "When I was 7 years old, the Bureau of Indian Affairs," what was that? Page 20 here. "When I was 7 years old, the Bureau of Indian Affairs sent me to Chumawa in Salem, Oregon. I did not see my family again until I was 14 years old. While I attended high school, part of my duties were to do housework and much of the cooking. In return, I received $15 a month and my room and board. When I was a girl, the education for an Indian was very mediocre. I firmly believe that education is the key to a great part of our problem. If we should receive a settlement on this land problem, we intend to use a great part of it to further the education of our people and improve the living conditions in general." Further down on page 20, Charlie Franz testified, "I believe that there should be a youth center for every bar in Alaska and a health center for every liquor store." Further down, this is, could still be said here. Further down, Larry Peterson testified, It is our duty to learn to live in the changed homeland. We can no longer use the bow and arrow to obtain our necessities. Our new tools must be ambition and education. We cannot stand tall and proud if we refrain from the pursuit of progress. We cannot be free if we do not try to break the binding chains of poverty and ignorance. Again, in reading this testimony, it sometimes appears when Alaska Natives were saying they wanted to be part of mainstream America, they wanted to join the wider society, this did not initially ring true to me. It was like a people seeking to escape their past. And my impression at the end of the testimony, but yet was, yes, that was true of their immediate past of powerlessness and poverty. Yes, they wanted out of that. Their traditional past, that's another story. Job training was also, to continue with this, on the job training was another expressed and felt need. On page 21, AFN's Flory Leekanoff testified, education for education's sake is not enough. Economic and industrial development must go hand in hand with the education process. Further down the page, there must be not only the formal and informal education, but the means through economic and industrial development in the native country for a new meaningful livelihood. So again, job training was desired to meet the practical goals of alleviating poverty and so that the natives could fully participate in the future, so that they could regain control of their destiny. The land claims was then felt as an opportunity for them to help themselves. And to make this point, I would quote Don Wright on page 23 of the paper. Don Wright testified, "I assure you that active participation in development was the basic reason for setting these, incorporating each village and incorporating the area-wide associations and incorporating one statewide association. And believe me, if this bill passes and if we do get some money to work with and some land, we will be competitive in every field in a very short period of time. They will be in control." This leads directly into the fourth identifiable concern in the testimony. And that concern is the achievement of self-sufficiency and self-determination. Different natives testified to different means to achieve this goal, but I would say they were pretty much unanimous in the desire to achieve independence and self-sufficiency. There was definitely expressed in the testimony an anti-wardship feeling, anti-reservationist, and anti-BIA attitude. And this issue surfaced at all levels of discussion, from specific requests for the control of the development of local resources onto more general and far-reaching anti-BIA diatribes. Natives expressed a desire for a new livelihood that they would control for their own purposes, not a livelihood that would control them. In the land claim settlement, they were asking for the tools to develop their own birthright in their own fashion. As Hugh Nichols put it, they wanted the tools. He wanted the tools to be a free man in a free society. As Emil Naughty stated, if there are going to be mistakes, we want to make them. And I would read a number of quotes to make this point, because I think this is one of the most important concerns expressed in the testimony. Eben Hobson on page 24 testified, "Who, if you please, is the better manager, the state or the natives? And so there you have it, Mr. Chairman. This is our land. If you want it, pay fair value for it. While we deny that our need or our competence are relevant factors to judge the amounts of land and money or both, our need is great and our competence is amply adequate for a reasonable, soon full control of our own compensation." Further down the page, Byron Mallett testified, "I sincerely believe and I submit that Alaska Natives have arrived at a point where we are ready to become the leaders in the achievement of our own destiny. Over the years, there had developed a nucleus of leadership, which I feel that the Native people have arrived at. at the point where we can pick up the reins. Continuing on page 25, Hugh Nichols testified, "Give the Eskimo title to his own land, and he will never, never again go to Congress as a supplicant to beg for the funds he so deservedly needs, desperately needs, to build his own future, for he shall then have the tools to move forward on his own initiative, a free man in a free society. One thing I thought as I sat in the audience here for the last 2 days, though, we are on the wrong side of the table. You should be over here asking for the land from us, and we should be over there giving it to you." Further down the page, Al Ketzler, "In the corporation, we want to be able to operate our own businesses. That is what it boils down to, and to have the say." And then finally, Emil Noti testifies at the bottom of the page there, "I point these things out because there is a strong feeling among the native people in Alaska that they want to have control of their own destiny. Again, and if there are going to be mistakes made, we want to make them. Not let the bad decisions be made in Juneau or even farther away in Washington, D.C. I stand here before you to state in the strongest terms possible that the representatives here today of 50,000 native people in Alaska do not want paternal guidance from Washington, D.C. And then finally, John Sackett from Huslia testified, "Our guardian for the past 50 years, the Bureau of Indian Affairs, was supposed to keep us from the ill influences of Western society. Instead, the Bureau has kept us 50 years behind the times. While the whole concept of the Bureau of Indian Affairs is to assimilate us into the mainstream of life, in each case the attitude has been, you aren't ready for it yet, and we will make the decisions. We are ready to decide what we as Native Alaskans want, and we are capable of handling our problems." These are strong statements, and these are only a few of the places where these statements were made in the testimony. The final issue that, the final concern that was expressed in the testimony, and after this I'll stop talking, was continuity in cultural integrity. As I see it, as the desire for independence and self-determination was implicit in the goal of full participation in the future, this desire to retain cultural integrity and cultural sovereignty was implicit in the desire for self-determination. The idea, as expressed in the testimony, was that Western material advantages would be used to support rather than to supplant the maintenance of traditional Native values. The maintenance of cultural integrity was a conscious goal in the testimony, but it had relatively low profile. It didn't get talked about explicitly a lot. But, however, it was clearly underlying the discussions of the inherent value of the land and the way of life that living off the land made possible. Thus, it was an implicit goal, while the testimony was dominated by the mechanics of the settlement, so it wasn't talked about explicitly that often. Again, the natives in the testimony expressed a desire to escape their immediate past of powerlessness and poverty, but not their past values. They were willing to conform with Western standards, but they did not want total integration. Now, it's interesting that formal statements about cultural integrity and the desire to retain cultural integrity give culture, in some cases, as separable, as one among a number of things that were desired to be accomplished. But informal statements throughout the testimony expressed culture as cultural integrity to be an all-encompassing system of values and an underlying system of beliefs that permeated choices in the activities in the realm of social and economic activities. And I think one of the best examples of that would be a statement by Charlie Edwardson on page 28 of the testimony. Charlie Edwardson testified, "I am never surprised but always dismayed when well-meaning but poorly informed people ask, why do not the Indians integrate themselves more effectively into the general society? This question, so frequently asked, is disarming because to answer it appropriately requires a considerably longer explanation than most inquirers have the patience to hear. To reply simply that probably they'd rather not, or contrawise, that they do not have the opportunity to integrate would not, either way, properly answer the question. Nor would it be very informative to reply that for the most part they do not have the opportunity, and that in any case they have strong attachment to their own cultural heritage and are understandably ambivalent in their reactions to the alien society which has engulfed them. This is, it seems to me, a reasonable statement of the case, but it is quite meaningless to anyone who is unfamiliar with the values on the one side of the equation, namely the character and equality of the cultural heritage to which Indians are attached. Again, in this statement, it seems to me that cultural values are not one spiritual aspect of life, but the integrity of the whole. Including economic acts of hunting, the social acts of sharing, and political acts of self-determination. As read in the testimony, in the 60s and in the late 60s, when this testimony was given, ANCSA was asked to move natives from impoverished dependence to social, political, and economic independence, with the emphasis being on the elimination of economic and political barriers to full participation in society. Today, with health, education, housing, and employment improvements made, and the corporations increasingly successful, you can see the emphasis, the explicit emphasis, again returning to an emphasis on maintained cultural integrity. In concluding, I'd like to make three points, three things that hit me over the head in reading the testimony. The first would be how many of the goals that Alaska Natives were asking of ANCSA have been met. The statistics, if you read Alaska and the and Natives and the Land, the Federal Field Committee report that was written in 1968, the statistics that they give about the condition of Alaska Natives are dated, thank goodness. They're no longer the housing conditions, the health conditions, the unemployment statistics have a dated ring. Strides have been made in housing, healthcare, especially in healthcare, and education. Yet social pathology still is severe among Alaska Natives. This, however, is not to be seen or cannot be seen as a fault of the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act, which again is only one part of the broader context of social change. Native society has been changing, and therefore society, and it is a society under stress. But this does say that the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act was no barrier to this stress. It was felt to be, it was hoped that it would be a solution, provide a solution to all of these problems. It has not been a barrier to the pathology that still exists in the Native community. The second major point, it seems to me, was that in the testimony, at any rate, the emphasis was on economic self-sufficiency and development. This emphasis was both pronounced and explicit of what was asked of ANCSA. If the Native community had reservations about the issue of the corporate vehicle, for instance, these reservations were not in the testimony. It was a positive pro-economic development, pro-self-sufficiency. That's the way the testimony read. Finally, and I think probably the most important point to be made, is that the major concerns expressed in the testimony persist to this day. The issues of dependence versus independence, of cultural amalgamation versus cultural integrity. Those issues, those same issues, are with us today. It's interesting that the catchphrase, people talked about the subsistence way of life and their desire to maintain the subsistence way of life. That phrase was there in the testimony in 1968. It was given, it seems to me, with the full belief that it was understood, that everything that was implied by that statement was understood by the people listening. It wasn't understood because natives are still trying to make those points today, are still needing to make those points today to the non-native community. And that's all I have to say there.
Well, thank you very much, Jan. We had the benefit of your paper in advance, and you've certainly helped us by highlighting the points that were made in it. Well, we can discuss the paper now. I thought if I would ask John Borbridge to begin the discussion, and then Don Wright, and then we can carry on from there. And in due course, I hope we will feel free to interrupt each other, ask questions, make comments, and proceed in that way. But perhaps you would offer your observations, John, now, please.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. I initially want to express my pleasure at hearing quite early in the presentation the reference to the land claims of the Alaska Natives as an assertion of land rights. It's something that marked a very significant beginning in the phraseology that we Natives were using at the time. We did, in a very earliest meeting, speak about land claims. It took a very short while for us to reach the point of speaking of land rights. Before launching into a formal response and commentary, I also want to express my appreciation to the chairman, whose clear manifestation of regard for cultural integrity included a regard for Native time. In accord with the highest traditions of AFN throughout the years, we did not start exactly on the button. You are to be complimented, Mr. Chairman. I think we would have considered something wrong if we had started right off at 9 o'clock. Secondly, I want to make it clear that I don't speak for the left. And thirdly, the non-appearance of some of my friends, I am told, has nothing to do with me. Mr. Chairman, the formation of the Alaska Federation of Natives in October 1966 was a pivotal event in the lives of the Alaska Indians, Eskimos, and Aleuts, who had previously responded to threats to their land, their cultures, and their lifestyles as individual Native associations and villages, and in many instances, as Native individuals. They had used and occupied their lands since time immemorial. In their exercise of dominion over it, they had defended it against all others. They lived on it as a tribe. They defended it as a tribe. That was how it had been. That was how it was when the state of Alaska began to take Native lands with papers that the federal government honored and a bureaucracy that resisted Native pleas to intercede. It required a series of crises of severe proportions to persuade the Alaska Native groups whose ancestors had spilled one another's blood over boundary disputes and trading routes to lay aside their differences in honor of a concept, statewide unity, and an organization, a statewide federation, that were alien to their cultures. The United States Atomic Energy Commission initiated plans in 1958 to set off a nuclear device to blast out a harbor at Cape Thompson near Point Hope. Nearby Eskimo villages, not having been consulted and fearing radioactive contamination of their historic hunting and fishing areas, opposed the project. In the early 60s, the state of Alaska, which planned to build a road into the recreation area, filed land selection applications for land in the Minto Lakes region of Interior, Alaska. In response to the request of villagers who feared added pressures on their subsistence areas, the BIA filed protests for almost 6 million acres for 4 area villages. How well I recall in reading about the hearings at which representatives of Minto and the sportsmen from Interior Alaska were present. One question was posed to them by Richard Frank, representing his people then. Is recreation worth the life of a village? In 1965, the federal government withdrew 9 million acres that included lands used for hunting, fishing, and trapping by Stevens Village, Beaver, and Birch Creek for the construction of a proposed Rampart Dam power project on the Yukon River. The project would have flooded traditional native lands was defeated. The villagers of Tanacross filed a land claim with the Bureau of Land Management in the early 50s that was finally rejected in 1961. Despite a BIA protest filed on their behalf in 1962, the state of Alaska selected land around the village in 1964. Villagers were later outraged to discover the state's plan to sell lots around their George Lake fishing grounds at its New York World's Fair booth in 1965. Millions of acres of valuable native lands were lost to state land selections, despite the very specific promise contained in the disclaimer clause in the Alaska State Constitution to maintain the status quo until the United States Congress could determine the extent of the native land rights. The enjoyment of native subsistence hunting and fishing was threatened by state land selections and the increasing restrictions being imposed by state and federal bureaucracies. The education of young natives, many of whom had to leave home to obtain a high school education, seemed to be less relevant to how they lived and less cognizant and appreciative of native values and the native culture. The natives began to recognize the value of having input in the planning, evaluation, and delivery of health services, initially in a negative sense, by realizing that it was no longer enough just to complain. The concern about a culture that was slowly slipping away became a major, though largely unstructured, concern across the state of Alaska. Housing, the safe water supply, also became priority issues. These and other events and crises precipitated the historic Native developments that culminated in AFN and the Alaska Native Claims Settlement Act. If AFN can be said to commemorate the foresight the Natives displayed in achieving a statewide unity, then ANCSA is a monument to the adaptability of a people who mastered, almost overnight, sophisticated new skills and weapons, and our government's response to our petitions for justice and equity to our ancient land rights. The victory was flawed, commonly the case in the face of such a complex situation, by unanswered questions and by inconsistencies and ambiguities in the Settlement Act itself. The early ANCSA congressional hearings were lightning rods that attracted Native testimony about a broad spectrum of concerns that range from land, subsistence hunting and fishing, and a changing culture to health, education, housing, and employment opportunities and self-determination. The Native people were not only addressing concerns about Native claimed lands that were being selected by the state of Alaska, but they were expressing their frustrations about things they didn't understand, about the immensity of the changes that were buffeting them, and about governments, state and federal, that didn't seem to be responding to them. The hearings were one time that government was prepared to listen. Government was translated simply into flesh and blood men who sat before them, to whom questions could be addressed. The Native leadership encouraged testimony on a broad spectrum of topics, although land use was intended to be the primary focus. The congressmen, after all, were being introduced to the users of the land, and more importantly, the users of the land were being introduced to the members of the Congress. The congressional committees were also receiving a demonstration, as was intended, that the Native leadership had the full support of the elders, the grassroots people, the actual users of the land, those who lived on, used, and occupied the land on a daily basis. It was intended that the Congress should be made aware that when we, as we planned at later hearings, discussed the concept of Indian or Aboriginal title, behind that concept were flesh and blood people. Also lending substance to the diversity of testimony was the determination of the elders to speak from the heart. We in the leadership positions at the time could inform the elders, sometimes through interpreters, what we wanted them to address or hoped they would discuss, knowing full well that they would say what they would say. In the native cultures, it has always been so, and it was thus during those early hearings in 1968 and 69. Not only did Native people testify about matters that were on their hearts, but the Native leadership undertook the task of translating those desires into concepts that would lead into the development of legislative provisions. It is clear at the outset that matters not falling into the jurisdiction of a Settlement Act would be addressed by AFN. What AFN would or could not do directly, it would persuade others to do. Thus, it was determined that it was important that there be no inhibitions placed on the testimony that the congressmen were to hear. Matters relating to the tribal status of the Alaska Natives and the sovereignty incident to that status were matters that fell outside the ambit of the proposed claims legislation. Still, it was true that many things that were presented at those hearings were matters that related directly to sovereignty and to tribal status, but it was not intended to be so. One effort to terminate the Alaska Natives was headed off at a later time by the Native leadership, so the fact was that termination was addressed as an issue. It was discarded as quickly as it arose by the leadership of the Alaska Natives. ANCSA was not intended to be, nor was it in actuality, termination legislation. The federal government's relationship with the Native Americans, of whom the Alaska Natives are an integral part, is of the highest legal standing, established through solemn treaties and a series of judicial decisions and legislative actions. It remains intact, though admittedly largely undefined, in Alaska.